Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Sally Alcordi, and welcome to Public Advocate Radio. When I don't have a guest, what I do is I record really important videos, and I have an incredible track record at knowing which ones will be removed. I'm not really laughing. It's not funny at all. Censorship kills. And even more than vaccines, censorship kills, because among the things censored are vaccines. Okay. I have four videos for you. The first one is going to require you to take action. So I'm putting that first. The first one is Alfred Lambremont Weber's Treaty of Rome. There is a call this Saturday, October 10th. Today is October 6th. And people from around the world are participating in this. And if you wish to, please contact Alfred Lambremont Weber at peace@peaceandspace.org. Okay, that's his email address for this particular project. Okay, the second is a recording from Spiro Skouras on the test, which is oh so important. And the first one is 2:29. Spiro's is 26:41. The next one is Dr. Reiner Fuhlmich, and that's Crimes Against Humanity. That is wildly important, and among the crimes that are being committed is he says this twice in the video, but I really have to tell you, in the Philippines, if you do not wear your mask, please, not even if you do not wear your mask, if you do not wear your mask correctly, you can be shot. Okay, what more do I need to say? Okay, number four is John Anthony, who is a hypnotherapist, who is going to tell you about the four phases of the collective trance. And basically, these are very sophisticated manipulation techniques that you do not even understand you are being put through. So this is from Jack Colton, who was kicked off Facebook years ago, and he has only sent me one video in 7 years, okay? This is it. I really beseech you to stay the course and listen to this entire recording. If by any chance it gets cut off, the live link to the video is number four in the roster of videos that I'm going to record right now. Please listen to it until the end. It only gets better as it goes and more insightful as it goes. So thank you, Jack Colton. You certainly have chosen a winner. Okay, and I believe that this is transformative. Everybody should hear this. Everybody, no matter what phase of enlightenment they're in, must hear this, okay, called the collective trance. Okay, so that's it. Four most worthy videos, no doubt, will be removed. And here's the first. Alfred Lambremont Weber is going to invite you to participate in, which one is it? Okay, just give me a second. Sorry. Okay, here we go. Thank you very much, Alfred.
Call for a pandemic treaty conference of the 118 nations that ratified the International Criminal Court Statute of the Treaty of Rome, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. This is a call for a pandemic treaty conference of the 118 nations that ratified the International Criminal Court Statute of the Treaty of Rome, banning war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and the crime of aggression. A similar treaty conference held in Canada in 1997 and championed by Princess Diana led to the banning of proliferating landmines. The mission of a pandemic treaty conference is set out in this call document and will result in a truth and reconciliation process ending genocidal mass vaccinations that cause crimes against humanity and are intended to irrevocably alter human DNA and trigger social control methods that cause irrevocable economic and social damage to the human divine being and society. You can download and translate the call for a pandemic treaty conference of the 118 nations that ratified the International Criminal Court Statute, Treaty of Rome, at peaceinspace.org, the links below. The heads of state and heads of government of the 118 nations ratifying the International Criminal Court Statute, Treaty of Rome, are urgently requested to convene a pandemic treaty conference. They and any organization and individuals interested in facilitating this process are requested to urgently contact peace@peaceinspace.org with a statement of intent and contact details. Thank you. Alfred Lambermont Weber.
Okay, that's the first video I wanted to share. I think he couldn't have been more clear, so I will not embellish and go directly to the next video. Okay, this is Spiro Skouras, who has been doing a magnificent job since the beginning of COVID, bringing us the truth. I would recommend you subscribe to his channel, as well as to Alfred Lambermont Weber's channel on YouTube. Okay, so this is about the test. The short version is don't take it. But nonetheless, this is a very, very good recording about the test. He calls it, "We Are Being Lied To, Here Is How." And here we go.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Spiro. Thanks for tuning in. The big news this week, of course, is that President Trump and his wife, the First Lady, both tested positive for COVID, and they are showing mild symptoms. Or at least that's what we're being told at this point. According to his doctor, the diagnosis was determined using the PCR test, just like everyone else we are told who has the virus. Now, the PCR test was invented in the 80s by an American biochemist named Kary Mullis, which won him the Nobel Peace Prize a decade later. So how could a test developed almost 40 years ago be used to diagnose what we are told is a brand new disease, which the world just became aware of last year? Well, from what I understand, it can't, but I'm not a doctor or a scientist, and I'm certainly not an expert or a biochemist like Kary Mullis. And we have seen a lot of false positives with the coronavirus testing. Many of these false positives are believed to be triggered by dead virus cells. We have seen examples of goats and fruit testing positive, which raises more questions than it answers. We have even seen a woman injured by a test after a nasal swab punctured her brain lining, causing brain fluid to leak from her nose. All of this due to a virus with a 99%+ survival rate for most who get it. Why is understanding this test so important? Because it is the driving factor of the fear campaign that is being driven by the media, the corrupt media, and then used by the government as a justification to impose restrictions on our lives. Now, on a positive note, it has been determined in Michigan by the state Supreme Court that the governor's restrictions were unconstitutional, and the same outcome was determined in Pennsylvania by a federal judge. Now, in this video, I'm going to play several different clips from people who are doctors, in addition to clips from the inventor of the PCR test himself. And I am fairly confident by the end of this report, you will come to the same conclusion that I have, that we are being lied to. Now, let's start with Kary Mullis, the inventor of the PCR test.
I want to ask this to Kary. How do they misuse PCR to estimate all these supposed free viral RNAs that may or may not be there?
I think misuse PCR is not quite – I don't think you can misuse PCR. No, the result, the interpretation of it. See, if you can say – If they can find this virus in you at all, and with PCR, if you do it well, you can find almost anything in anybody. It starts making you believe in the sort of Buddhist notion that everything is contained in everything else, right? I mean, because if you can amplify one single molecule up to something that you can really measure, which PCR can do, then there's just very few molecules that you don't have at least one single one of them in your body, okay? So that could be thought of as a misuse of it, just to claim that it's meaningful. But the real misuse of it is that you don't need to test for HIV. You don't need to test for the other 10,000 retroviruses that are unnamed, also in the subject. Somebody that's got HIV generally is going to have almost anything that you can test for, because they have definitely been, HIV is a fairly rare virus. There's only 1 million of us out of 250, 300 million people in America that have that virus. So you have to get around. Either your mother had to have it and pass it to you, or you have to really be paying a lot of attention to people that do have it and paying only attention to them and get a pretty good chance of getting it that way. It's hard to get it. But if you have it, there's a good chance you've also got a lot of other ones. Because you've been in the market where it's been possible for you to get a lot of to test for that one and say that has any special meaning is what I think is the problem. Not that PCR has been misused. It's like, it's not an estimation. It's a really quantitative thing. It tells you something about nature and about what's there, but it allows you to take a very minuscule amount of anything and make it measurable and then talk about it in meetings and stuff like it is important. See, that's not a misuse. That's just sort of a misinterpretation. There's very little of what they call HIV, and what's been brought out here by Philpott and Isai already, the measurement for it is not exact at all. It's not as good as our measurement for things like apples. An apple is an apple. You know, you can get something that's kind of like, if you got enough things that look kind of like an apple and you stick them all together, you might think it's an apple. But and HIV is like that. Those tests are all based on things that are invisible, and they are, the results are inferred in a sense. PCR is separate from that. It's just a process that's used to make a whole lot of something out of something. That's what
also,
it is. But it's not, it doesn't tell you that you're sick, and it doesn't tell you that the thing you ended up with really was going to hurt you or anything like that. That's what it's not.
So even if you believe in HIV, it can't tell the difference between virus particles or active live virus. I mean, there's a lot of questions.
So I hope you caught that. Towards the end, in particular, when Mullis is talking about tests, well, he differentiates PCR from tests. He calls it a process to take a tiny amount of something and make a whole lot more out of it. Mullis also, very importantly, states that PCR does not tell you that you were sick, and it does not tell you that if what you have will make you sick. So right there, according to the inventor of PCR himself, it is not capable and should not be used as a diagnostic test to determine false or positive test results. Yet this is the standard test being used worldwide to diagnose. Then, based off of those results, the government imposes COVID-1984 restrictions around the world. Now, it looks like a fraud to me. So what would Kerry Mullis say today about PCR as it's being used as a test for COVID? Sadly, we will never know, because Mullis, the age of 74, on August 7th, 2019, just before the outbreak began. The official cause of death, pneumonia. But we can gather an idea of what Mullis might have said based on what he has said in the past regarding AIDS and HIV.
The first time I really questioned it, I was working on a project where we were measuring HIV in people's blood at this place called Specialty Laboratories in Santa Monica. I was just a consultant there. I came in about 3 days a month, and we were working on that. And at some point, we needed to re-up our grant from the NIH to work on that, and I had to write it. And so the first line of that was, HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. And I wrote that, and then I said, well, I need a paper, some kind of scientific paper, to reference that statement, because when you make a statement like that, that's like a fact. So you need to say, here's how come I know that, right? You put a little one if it's the first statement you've made, and then you put down at the bottom of the paper, you have a one, and you say, here's a paper by somebody that describes why that statement's true, right? And so I said, well, what's that? I don't know. Let me think about, what is that paper? Who do I go to for that? And I looked around, I asked a couple of virologists at that company, and they said, no, you don't have to reference. I said, I have to reference that because I don't know where that came from. How do I know that? And it turned out that nobody knew it. There wasn't a scientific reference, like a paper that somebody has submitted with like experimental data in it and like logical discussion and said, here's how come we know that HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. There was nothing out there like that. Nothing.
Speak about your experience when you met Luke Moss and questioned him about
by the time I met Luke Montagnier, I had met a lot of AIDS researchers at meetings, and I had always gone up to them. If they talked like they knew about HIV and AIDS, I always went up to them afterwards, and I said, where can I find a scientific reference that I can use for my – remember I said I had a sentence there that said HIV is the probable cause of AIDS, and I needed to have that backed up by something before I could write it and submit it. And I went around, I asked a whole lot of people. I said, well, I can't find it. I looked for it, you know, just in computer searching kind of stuff like that. But then I said, got to be somebody that knows this. So you go to experts and ask them. And so I asked all these people one after the other, and none of them had it. None of them. And I was getting really freaked about that. That's when I first started thinking, they don't know. Nobody really does. This whole thing. It's a big sham. It's ridiculous. But then finally Montagnier came to there was a special little seminar down in San Diego where an old friend of Robert Gallo's, Flossie Wungstahl, was opening up the Department of AIDS Research down in San Diego. They had big, lots of money involved, federal money, and they had Montagnier come there and give a talk. And after that, they had a little wine and cheese thing, and I went over to Montagnier afterwards, and I said, Dr. Montagnier, I can't find a reference. I can't find a reference to go with the statement HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. I'm sure you can help me. And he knew that he probably should be able to help me. And he said, well, why don't you quote this new work? This, and by new, he meant like something that came out this year. Right? This new work about a virus that can kill monkeys. Or I think it was not monkeys. It was like something related to monkeys, some kind of baby, a little ape. And I had read that, and I said, that didn't – it was like supposedly going to be a model system for studying AIDS. If somebody had figured out some kind of retrovirus – that passing it back and forth between various mammals, they could finally put it into chimpanzees and kill them. And it killed them in about a week. And it didn't kill them in any, there was nothing like AIDS there. You know, it doesn't kill you in a week. This is totally ridiculous. None of the symptoms were the same. And I said, well, you know, I read that paper and I didn't see any connection between that and AIDS, and I don't think that would be a real. I wouldn't want to use that as a reference. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but I know he walked away. Oh, no! Before he told me about that paper, he said, "Why don't you use the NIH, like the CDC report?" And I said, "Well, I looked at that, and that was not a scientific paper." And then he said, "What about this other thing? This like paper that had just come out about a month before, and it a lot of fanfare associated with that paper, but it was total crap. It was like, yeah, if you got $2 million, you can figure out how to kill a primate with a retrovirus. So what? Doesn't have anything to do with AIDS. It didn't look like AIDS. It didn't smell like AIDS. It wasn't AIDS. It was just like got a retrovirus that can kill a chimpanzee. So what? So I didn't get any more out of him. He walked away after that. And the people standing around, by the way, who were his colleagues there, looked at him like they were thinking he should come up with a better answer than that. But he couldn't, and he just turned around and walked away. I really thought he'd have an answer. I really did. I mean, that was my last. I was right at the edge of my faith in the system. But I thought, Montagnier will know why he thinks HIV causes it. And he'll tell me, he'll say, because of this study. You know, but he didn't have that. None of those guys have that. And that's why they're so weird, you know. That's why they don't want to say, they don't want people like me walking up and asking them those kind of questions. And they're willing to, like, go to great lengths to prevent that. They're out on a limb. I wouldn't want to be there with them.
Almost chilling words at the end there from Mullis. They don't want people like him, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, around asking questions, and that they are willing to go to great lengths to prevent that. Mullis was indeed a thorn in the side of the establishment during the time of the HIV-AIDS debate. He was very outspoken towards people like Dr. Fauci. Here's a quote from Mullis on Fauci from a lengthy but fantastic article called, "Was the COVID-19 test meant to detect the virus?" Quote, "What ABC needs to do is talk to Fauci and Gallo and show their assholes, which I could do in 10 minutes, end quote. Now, personally, without knowing Mullis, I have to admit that I like him, and I have little doubt in my mind, from my own point of view, that if he were alive today, the powers that be would not be able to use PCR to perpetuate this manufactured crisis in the way that they are right now today. He was a thorn in their side then, and I'm sure he would have been an even bigger thorn in their side now. Now, this raises suspicions with me regarding the timing of his death just weeks before the outbreak. No disrespect to the family, and I have no proof at this point to go off of that. But again, the timing does raise some questions, I think, that should be looked into. Now, I'm going to play some more clips here. Some of these clips were sent to me. Some of them were put together by other people doing some great work out there, showing how the manipulation is taking place and several examples of doctors calling out the lies.
Good afternoon. And we're starting off with the overall rates in terms of confirmed cases. As you can see on this graph, the numbers are now going up and going up really much more rapidly. The test that we have for the virus does not tell us whether we have an active virus in a person. It's being called by the media a case.
And the UK has recorded almost 3,000 new cases of coronavirus.
The rise in the number of cases that we've seen today is concerning.
A case is when someone gets sick from a disease. That's completely different from a positive test.
It's not a case at all. It's just that we can detect that at some time in the past, perhaps, there has been viral infection, but it's probably been removed now.
Even if there is some asymptomatic transmission, in all the history of respiratory-borne viruses of any type, asymptomatic transmission has never been the driver of outbreaks.
You must not meet socially in groups of more than six. And if you do, you will be breaking the law.
It has what's been calculated as an infection fatality rate. That is, if you catch the infection, probability of you dying is 0.3%. So that means that 99.7% of people survive. 80% of people who catch this virus will be completely asymptomatic. Those people who do catch the virus, many of them, the effect will be like a bad flu. Those people who are actually hospitalized, then we do have very good treatments for these.
And anyone breaking the rules risks being dispersed, fined, and possibly arrested. As your Prime Minister, I must do what is necessary to stop the spread of the virus and to save lives.
The government reaction is causing more deaths now and will cause far more deaths in the future than the virus itself.
Positive tests do not equal cases. Very important to remember. And I think that many would agree the response has been worse than the crisis itself. Now, here is Dr. Thomas Cowan breaking down the PCR test and how it can be used to manipulate the crisis.
The test is called a RT-PCR test. It's otherwise known as a viral load test. And the test is a surrogate test. It was developed by a guy named Kerry Mullis, who was given the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for essentially inventing the technique of this test. And he said very specifically, you cannot use this test to either prove infectious etiology or to diagnose an infectious disease. Which, of course, is interesting because if you can't use it to diagnose an infectious disease, that, of course, begs the question of what can you use it for? But let me back up here and describe what a surrogate test means, because this is very important to understanding the situation we're currently in. A surrogate test means that in a situation where you're trying to prove causation, you have to have a gold standard test. And those postulates, like with meningococcus, that is a gold standard test. it's reliable 100% of the time. You cannot use a surrogate test to prove anything. And that is what is happening with these tests. So what is the surrogate test? So remember that we don't have a gold standard. We don't have isolation, purification, reinfection. We don't have viremia. We don't have millions of copies demonstrated on an electron microscope. We essentially have no idea who has this coronavirus disease. So then they take a piece of one of the coronaviruses, the new one that they found. It has a new RNA sequence that hasn't been found before. They take one of the sequences, which they say is unique to that particular virus, and they do something called amplifying. And what that means is you take in your blood, you'll have one copy of this sequence, and it's too small, you can't find it. So you stimulate it, and this is what Carrie Mullis came up with. You stimulate it, it makes two copies. That's one cycle. You make four copies. That's two. You make 2 to the 20th copies, whatever number that is. And what you find with this test is that once you put it through approximately 36 cycles, then you start to see the color change that tells you it's positive. So if you do 35 cycles, it's still too small to see. If you do 36, you start to see it, but you get false negatives, even though you don't really know which is a false negative because you don't have anything to compare it with. So then you do 37 and you see it, you know, 5% of the time of people with these symptoms, and you say that's the number. But here's where it gets interesting. If you do it 40 times, you start seeing a lot more positive. And then here's something else to know. If you do it 60 times, so if you amplify it over and over and over again, it becomes positive with 100% of the people. Let me say that again. If you amplify it 60 times, it will be positive with everybody. That means that everybody has a piece of this RNA somewhere in their cells or in their genome or somewhere in their secretions. All you have to do is amplify it enough. And the problem is we don't know how many false positives or false negatives there are because we have nothing to compare it to. And if the, you know, all biological tests have false positives. So if you test 30 million people and you have a 1% false positive rate, then 300,000 people by definition will test positive. And then you have an epidemic. And then if you want to demonstrate that the epidemic got better, all you have to do is lower the amplification cycles to 35, and then suddenly your, you know, vitamin C or your vaccine or your chloroquine or whatever you did worked, and now there's no more people testing positive. That is fraught with problems, and that is the problem. And unfortunately, with every country has their own standard of what kind of cycles they put it through, the number. So you see very different numbers coming out of very different places depending on the number of amplification cycles that they're standardizing their test to. And I hope everybody is getting the point that this is a crazy situation.
A crazy situation indeed. A manufactured crisis, in my opinion. A very astute point made by Dr. Cowan. Depending on the amount of amplifications, you can affect the positive or negative rates. So you could have a very high amplification rate in the numbers and therefore would have a very high positivity rate in the cases or the tests, right? Then you roll out the vaccine and lower the amplification during the tests, and then you would get less positive cases, right? And hey, wouldn't you know it, then you have an effective vaccine. Now, this last clip is from Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis having a conference last week speaking with the doctor about testing, contact tracing, and the lockdowns. By the way, Governor DeSantis said previously that Florida would never again lock down while he is governor. I wish my governor would say the same.
Not just general testing and PCR testing, whether you should test asymptomatic people, just symptomatics, how many contacts. Dr. Bhattacharya, what is the this asymptomatic testing with PCR, but particularly I think one of the things that's been put out, the New York Times had an article about a month ago looking at some of the test results in New York and in, I believe, Nevada and Massachusetts, and they found that because the PCR tests are so sensitive that up to 90% of the positives were not identifying live infectious virus. And then I think there's other studies that have come out. I know Oxford's Center for Evidence-Based Medicine says that if you have such high sensitivity, you cannot be any, there's no guarantee you're even identifying live virus. And I think that, I guess, one, just what does that mean for some of the testing and the case numbers that we see? But then two, it seems to me that if you're test positive with no symptoms with a very sensitive PCR test, and they can't even tell you if you're infectious, we're quarantining across the country, mm-hmm. probably hundreds of thousands or millions of people who aren't even contagious. And I think that obviously has a huge cost to society. Doesn't seem to be getting a lot of discussion, though.
But the key thing about the PCR technology that I think is important for this discussion is that the especially you're doubling the genetic material if it's present, or the virus if it's present, right? If you have a very tiny amount of the virus, or if it's a viral fragment that's not actually that your body has successfully attacked, your immune system is successfully attacked, then what you're amplifying is something that's not going to pose any risk either to you or to others. So you're asymptomatic. The PCR, you're positive with a PCR. It's not a false positive in a technical sense, but in a functional sense, it's a false positive. Epidemiologically, it's a false positive, right? I'm not going to infect you, even though I have this vial, even though I'm PCR positive, because it took so many doublings to reach the point that we can infer that there really wasn't very much genetic material for the virus present to begin with. I think that you're absolutely right to point out the cost of that when you attach it to a policy of contact tracing and isolation and quarantine. We effectively are quarantining people on the basis of PCR tests, a functional false positive PCR test, where it will have no effect on disease spread because they're not infectious. At the same time, we'll impose enormous costs on them. There's another follow-on cost of that is that it makes people less willing to cooperate with contact tracers because they know the costs. If I am contact traced and I'm asked to say who I've interacted with, I know if I tell I interact with, you know, with my friends, they're going to be facing the same thing. They might get quarantined, and if it's as possible as a false positive, a functional false positive, then I'm imposing costs on them for nothing. I think in LA County, I saw an LA Times story that 60% of people who are contacted, who put in touch with contact tracers, they won't cooperate with them. You can see why. The cost of essentially ratting your friends out is enormous.
The cost has been enormous, and it's been affecting billions of people around the world. There are so many more clips of other doctors and experts that I could have included, but I think you get the point. Personally, I believe, as I have documented in numerous previous reports, that this is part of a much larger agenda, and this is a manufacturing crisis. But it's the mechanism, it's the vehicle to transition in from this current system of control into the new and improved digitalized system of control. The window of opportunity to change course diminishes more and more each passing day. I truly believe this is the most important time of our lives and a deciding point in history that will determine humanity's future. I hope you found this report useful. For ActivistPulse.com, I'm Spiro. Thanks for watching.
Fantastic reporting, as always, by Spiro Sekouros. Now, let me go to the next video. Hold on just one second, please. Okay, well, we are out of time, and that's my fault. I should have set the show for longer, but I guess I was so eager to get this on the air that I didn't. So please get a pen and pencil now, or type into somebody's message box, okay? tinyurl.com, tinyurl.com/beating, BEATING, adults. tinyurl.com/beatingadults. The reason I drive you to this blog is because it has what I was going to play for you next on YouTube, but it also has a backup recording on Brighteon. So this one I actually didn't need to back up, but I really wanted to share it with you. Dr. Reiner Fulme, Crimes Against Humanity. Very important video. I really cannot stress that enough. So see it, either click the link below the screen, and if that doesn't work, go to tinyurl.com/beatingadults. The next video that I was going to record for you but will not have time because of my own error was John Anthony, The Collective Trance. It is basically addressing manipulation and the absolutely nuanced. These psychopaths have really got this down. And whether you are in the know or completely unknowing, you will learn so much. And I emphasize again, you must listen to the end. There are four stages. It only gets more interesting as he goes. And that's a gentleman by the name of John Anthony. Okay, so those are the four recordings that I had for you today. I do not have a backup of John Anthony's The Collective Trance, but you can see if you can see it on YouTube. There is no backup other than what was going to be this program. And it's a very long video, that one. It's an hour and 43 minutes, which is why I stress you must stay to the end because it's worth your time. So let's see what else. Yes, if you go to tinyurl.com/public advocate, which is where you're hearing this show on Blog Talk Radio, but the tinyurl.com/public advocate, and watch yesterday's program, which was with attorney Tom Renz, R-E-N-Z. You will see the date of that is October 5th, because today is October 6th. You will listen to a very important lawsuit that is transpiring in Ohio, and it basically is not taking the tact of many other lawsuits. It is in, I won't go through all of those, but I will say the tact it is taking is what pandemic, what emergency, prove it. Prove that there is actually an emergency. And they will not be able to prove it, you know? So this is a really important lawsuit. And he says that he's happy to help people in other states by using all of the materials he has gathered. And I am, when I get off the air from you, I sent him a group of materials I had gathered that I thought were pertinent and that he should investigate. And I'm going to send him what may be 10 blogs of mine that I have done on COVID since its inception, and see if there's anything that he can find in those that will fill in the blanks that he might need. You know, I've had over 60 interviews on this issue. So just those might be what he's looking for. I don't think he needs any more evidence. The whole thing is, as with vaccines, the evidence is all on the side of the vaccine aware. But there are, when I say the vaccine aware, the people who do not want children ever to receive even one, okay, that's the vaccine aware. The people who don't even want to give a choice about vaccines because it's, would you offer someone a glass of arsenic? No, and you might even get arrested for doing that, just for offering it. Likewise, we should never offer vaccines to human beings or animals, and certainly not to small ones. Also, well, that's it. This is October Vaccine Injury Awareness Month. I have put some pictures in rotation on the recording so that, you know, just to bring attention to Vaccine Injury Awareness Month, but look at the picture of that little baby with the mask on, a newborn. They are depriving a newborn of oxygen. And this is not the only picture I have. I've seen many, and I have two others. And it is sick as it gets. But if they're vaccinating children the day, they're sicker than that. Okay? All right. Well, goodbye, everyone. And I apologize for creating a shorter video than I had audio than I had expected to. But I've sent you to all the sources where you can find backup or at least the original. Okay? All the very best. Thank you very much for listening. And please contact Alfred Lambremont Weber if you are in one of the 118 countries that has ratified the international, let me get the correct title here, that it says call for a pandemic treaty conference of the 118 nations that ratified the International Criminal Court Statute Treaty of Rome. The U.S. is not one of them. Neither is Russia, China, Iran, or Israel. 139 have signed it, but only 118 have ratified it. And you'll be able to see it at the links below the link that I've put under the radio show. Okay, it'll list all 118 countries that have ratified the International Criminal Court Statute Treaty of Rome. Okay. Well, thank you very much for contact him at peace@peaceandspace.org, because this Saturday, October 10th, he's having a conference on this, and you can participate if you will contact him forthwith, okay? And if you know people in one of these 118 nations who would like to participate, believe me, we welcome them, you know. Enlightened people are always welcome, but, you know, we're trying to save all the unlightened ones too. So, all right. Take care, and thank you very much for tuning in to Public Advocate Radio today. My name is Sally L. Cordy, your host, and if you'd like to learn about the history of October Vaccine Injury Awareness Month and what it is we are expecting of you or hoping you will participate in, three different things this month, please go to tinyurl.com/historyOctober. Okay, bye-bye.